You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Alex toku ingoa, nau mai hari mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Ratu Tuesday. I'm your host Alex and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in studio by producer Liam. E whai ake nei coming up on the show. For Dear Science this week, our expert, Professor Alan Blackman, chats with us about taking too many vitamins, bees, and AI failing psychological tests. For our weekly catch-up with the National Party, I spoke with MP Ryan Hamilton about the US threat of further tariffs on New Zealand, a relationship with the US, and changes to local government committees to limit the impact of unelected members. Liam, what do you have for us today?
Hi Alex, this week I spoke to a range of people, including Chris Casey of the Cachet Foundation, about the current deteriorating state of the former Carrington Hospital in Mount Albert, which is a Category 1 heritage building, also known as Building 1, and efforts to see it restored and repurposed.
Hea ha o whakaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or waiamai rāne, give us a call in studio on 309-3875-3879. Kaua e wareware e āhei ana koutou, te whakarongo ke ēnei kōrero āno, hei pakeheri rokiroki mā runga i te pai, tukutuku o irirangi poho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Kia timata te whakaturanga, let's get into the show.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
For Dear Science today, we're joined by our expert, Professor Alan Blackman. Welcome.
Thank you, Alex. It's actually nice out there.
Yeah, it was really cold this morning, but now it's sunny.
Nice,
it's,
yeah.
It's a nice change.
Good crisp winter day, there we go. Yeah.
What does science have for us today?
Oh, many things. So we're going to kick off talking about vitamins, as you alluded to earlier. And so the question is, are vitamins good for you? And there's sort of an answer that's not necessarily a yes or a no. Well, obviously yes, but it turns out that you can't have too much of a good thing, okay? So let's go back to the year 2000. That was a big year. And in 2000, the USA officially announced that they'd eradicated measles, which is a great thing because measles is nasty. I remember having measles when I was a kid. Now, again, all of you in the studio are too young to remember, as bloody usual. You're all too young to remember that. But, yep, no, I went through measles, which was sort of a rite of passage in those days. But, you know, it's potentially very nasty. And, you know, people die from measles. Children die. So it's not a particularly good thing. And to have it eradicated is really good. And the reason it's eradicated is because of intensive vaccinations. Okay. Now, funnily enough, starting in the year starting in January 2025, the USA had an outbreak of measles. Now, why would they have that? I can't possibly think.
I wonder.
Nothing comes to mind.
Yeah.
But since January 2025, they had 4,271 cases up to May 28th, 2026. So, you know, this isn't a small number necessarily. So, in just after this outbreak occurred, a lady by the name of Dr. Suzanne Humphreys appeared on a thing called the Joe Rogan Show. I've never heard of, you know.
I'm familiar.
The Joe Rogan podcast. She appeared on that in February 2025. And her big thing was, so we've got a measles outbreak. So she is a doctor. She was busy touting vitamin A and cod liver oil as being cures So you could treat measles with vitamin A and cod liver oil. Now, vitamin A, obviously it's good for you. It's a vitamin, so you need it. It is essential, and it's essential for things like growth and vision and cell operations.
All
cell
the
function,
good stuff.
All of those things that we need, okay? And so, you know, as I said, we're talking about immunization here, that you know, most children are immunized, but the immunization rates, certainly in the States, have been falling over the past few years. So she was busy saying, okay, we've got vitamin A, cod liver oil, blah, 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 blah. So following her appearance on the Joe Rogan show, there were a big spike in the number of Google searches for vitamin A measles, cod liver oil measles, okay? So some scientists, some social scientists in the USA decided to have a look at these searches and actually sort of quantify them. So what they found was that the searches for vitamin A / measles went up 7.5% over just what would normally be expected, and the cod liver oil measles went up 1.3% over what would be expected, okay? So far, so good, sort of the thing that you might expect. However, at the same time, the poison centers in America reported, get this, a 38.7% spike in children's exposure to dangerous amounts of vitamin A, okay? And so basically they are linking these two things. And then you're listening there and you think, well, dangerous amounts of vitamin A, sure, there's no such thing. Well, there absolutely is. And excess vitamin A can lead to such things as nausea and headaches and dizziness and liver damage and, in serious cases, actually death. Okay?
Okay, so and don't take too much vitamin
don't
A.
Don't take too much vitamin A, okay? And here's this person on the Joe Rogan show busy saying, oh, yes, vitamin A, blah, 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 blah. So I always like telling this story. It's a horrendous story, actually. But we go back all the way to 1912 and an Australian Antarctic explorer by the name of Douglas Mawson. Very, very famous guy. He set out with three, well, there was a group of three of them, set out to explore the inner workings of Antarctica, etc., together with, you know, a few dogs, a couple of sleds, etc., etc. And then one day they went over a crevasse. One of them went down the crevasse with the sled that contained all of the food and everything. So there were two of them left, just basically the two of them and the dogs. And so they had to get back to civilization, and so away they went. And the dogs started dying one by one because obviously they weren't getting fed, and so therefore they would start eating the dogs. So when a dog died, they would start feeding the dogs to the other dogs, and plus they would eat it themselves to survive. And the worst part of the dogs was the muscle or something, so they fed those to the dogs. The best part was the liver. Okay, and so they started chowing down on the liver. Now, unbeknownst to them, the liver concentrates vitamin A, especially dog liver. So you've got lots and lots of vitamin A in dog liver. So unintendingly, what was happening was that they were slowly getting poisoned by vitamin A. And so one of them actually succumbed, so they believe, to vitamin A poisoning. Really, really, really nasty things start happening. Your skin starts peeling off, okay? And the soles of Mawson's feet actually started peeling
off. That's quite grim.
Okay, grim is one word for it, yeah. And so eventually Mawson made it back. It was a heck of a journey, but the other guy by the name of Mertz, he ended up unfortunately succumbing to vitamin A poisoning. So, and the sort of one of the reasons why it can be bad for you is because it's soluble in fat. It's not soluble in water, so you can't pee out any excess. Like things like vitamin C and stuff like that, you can always, you know, pee out. You can't do that with this. So it concentrates in the fat in the body and everything. You can't necessarily get rid of it easily. So I think there's a lesson there somewhere in all of that. But, you know, beware of what you believe when you listen to podcasts.
Yeah.
You know, just believe what I say, sort of thing. You know?
The experts.
Yeah, the experts. Yeah, believe the – I think we've talked about this.
We have. That's almost an exact kind of situation that would be, right? Believe in the opinions, not the expertise.
Yes, yeah.
But, okay, wow. That's a health PSA. What up next? I think we've got my favourite insect.
Yes.
I love bees.
And I do get a chance to shout out to my favourite TV program ever, probably Arrested Development. Bees, but nobody has seen Arrested Development because you're all too young. Again, good grief. Everyone should go and watch Arrested Development. It's the funniest program ever, 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 mate. Anyway, so here's a question. Are humans the most intelligent species on the planet?
Wow.
And I think being humans, we would probably like to think that we are. I think we probably are, but you know, there are many sort of species, living species, that can do stuff that we can't, I think. But normally you sort of look at insects and you think, ah, insects, pah, you know, what do they know? Well, it turns out actually quite a lot. And so a bunch of Finnish researchers were interested in studying bumblebees and whether or not bumblebees could actually do problem solving. Okay, oh. Because that's something that, you know, humans can obviously do, and that's possibly something that distinguishes us from many living things on the planet. And so what they discovered is that, yes, that bumblebees actually can problem solve, which is very, very interesting. So what they did was they set up this little enclosure, and in this little enclosure, which sort of wasn't big enough for the bees to fly, what they had was they put a blue artificial flower on the roof of this little enclosure, and that's covered in sort of sucrose and stuff, so it's a nice sugary treat for the bumblebee if it can get there. And inside the enclosure was this little styrofoam ball, and basically what the bee had to do was to roll the styrofoam ball to a position under the flower, then he can climb up on the styrofoam ball and you know, get that sugary treat. And that was the only way that he could get the sugary treat, okay? So so the question was, could the bumblebees actually figure out that this is what they had to do? So what they did was they divided the bees into three groups, okay? So the first group had seen both the styrofoam ball and the blue flower separately, okay? The next group had had seen one of the blue flower or the styrofoam ball, okay? And the third group had seen neither beforehand, okay? And so what they found was that only the bees that had seen both before, so both the styrofoam ball and the blue flower, could actually solve the problem of how to get to the sugary treat, okay? And so there's a wonderful video that accompanies this, that they actually videoed the bees, and he's busy rolling the styrofoam ball and then climbing up on the ball, and it's all quite brilliant. But there was the possibility that the bees were just maybe getting lucky rolling the ball to the right place, because apparently bees are known to be able to roll balls. They've seen this before.
This has been studied.
This has indeed been. I don't know who studies this, but people do. So they had to take the chance factor away. And so what they then did was that they sort of divided the enclosure into two, so that the ball was sort of in one half of the enclosure, the flowers in the other half of the enclosure, and that the bee couldn't see the flower in the part of the enclosure where the ball was. So he'd have to trot around, have a look where the flower was, trot back, figure out where the ball is, and then figure out how to get the ball around to where the flower was. So that takes the chance factor out of it, apparently. And so they did this, and what they found was that 23 of the 30 bees got this right the first time. That's quite astonishing.
That's a good turnout.
And so they're sort of likening it to maybe giving a human a hammer and a nail, but something that they've never actually seen before. So this is the whole point of the thing, that the bees had never seen these things before, okay? And so there's no training at all. Nothing at all. They're just given these two things essentially, and being asked to put them together and figure out how to do this. And as I say, like giving somebody who's never seen a hammer and a nail a hammer and a nail. Given enough time, you're going to figure out what to do with the hammer and the nail. But if you're only given a nail, or you're only given a hammer, and then you're sort of given the other half straight away and everything, then you're not necessarily sure what to do with it. And so basically, they are taking this as proof that now the bees are actually problem solving, that this is them essentially thinking on the fly. And what they noticed was that the bees would take a certain amount of time, that it was almost like they were sort of, you know, walking around and actually thinking, like humans would do probably, you know, how to actually solve this problem. How do I get from there to there? How do I do this? And I think it's brilliant. Absolutely
awesome.
Brilliant. Yeah.
Cool little guys.
So there you go. Who'd have thought it? Bees, huh? Bees!
And
Arrested
what,
Development.
And just what? Shout out.
Yes.
And what do we have to finish this up?
To finish this up, the Stroop task. Anyone know what the Stroop task is?
Not a single bell is ringing.
Okay. This is really cool, actually, and I have tried this, and it's bloody difficult. But, okay, so you get a list of words, and these words are colours, okay? Except the colour that the word is printed in is a different colour from what the word actually is, okay? So you've got the word yellow, but it's printed in green. And you've got the word blue, but it's printed in red. And what you then have to do is to go down the list of these words, and you have to say not what the word is, but what the colour is, what the actual colour that they're printed in is. And it's really quite tough, okay? But humans can basically do this. It just takes them a while. You know, you've actually got to sit down and actually think about what you're doing, you know.
Kind of grasp the point.
You've got to suppress your vision of the actual word, the writing of the word, and you've got to focus on the actual colour that the word is written in. So that's the Stroop task, okay? And so, as I say, that's quite difficult for humans, but it's absolutely doable. So if humans can do it, then supposedly AI can do it, because AI can do everything, okay? Hooray, okay. So some workers in the USA decided to test a bunch of AI LLMs on how good they are at doing this. And basically what they found was that they're okay, but the longer the list, the worse they get. And they're kind of equating it to sort of AI being a bit bored, okay? Getting a bit bored with going through this. So what they found was a 91% accuracy for a list of 5 words, okay? 91% accuracy. But you go to 40 words and it goes down to 15% accuracy, okay? Which is not great, really. Now, the really tricky one is where they mix them up, okay? Now, the list of words has your particular colour written in not the same colour, okay? But now they've got a mixed list where some of the words have the correct colour and some of them are written in different colours, okay? So that's a mixed list. So that makes it really, really tough. Okay, and what they found was that the LLMs were close to 0% when they actually mixed these. Okay, and so you know the AI is concentrating on what's written. Okay, it can't seem to stop looking at the actual letters and the words and focus on the actual colour. So you know there is, dare I say it, yet another failing of AI. So maybe we shouldn't be quite so quick to, you know, adopt this. Maybe let's wait until it's a bit better, huh?
Yeah, maybe let's think about the things that we can actually do without it.
Anyway, they're not going to take over your job, Alex. No. Surely not.
One can hope. Well, anyway, thanks, Ellen, for joining us. Thank you, Motet, and thank you, Science. Ngā Kōrero Rererangi Aviation Conversations returns on 2nd of July. Enjoy a lively panel discussion on the Dark Sky Movement featuring guest speakers Nikki MacArthur, MNZM, and Josh Aoraki. Book now at motet.nz.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
We'll be right back. Text 5395 with any of your thoughts on these pieces.
Bust engine of hope, this once great nation I left is its humour. So be it, through continuing mockery, this crackpot country are full of cunts. We'll finally have the last laugh when dragged underwater by the weight of the tumour it formed, and when it fell for the fear-mongering of the National Front's new hairdo. Becomes of the inhabitants of this once unstoppable isle, when all of its exports are no longer in style. Are you seriously still trying to kid me that all culture will be just fine when all we've left is knobheads Morris dancing to Sham 69? Go on the ragman or roll around the maypole, hijack the sound and stake your claim to it. Every card played is a statement made, and there's always a new scapegoat to blame for it. England, my heart bleeds, why'd you abandon me? Yes, I abandoned you too, but we both know I wasn't the one lied to, and I'm not scared of people who don't look like me, unlike you. Cease to fight by its own stupidity. Does not realize it has already sentenced itself completely to death. The last bastion of hope this once great nation had left was good music, but we didn't nurture it, instead choosing to ignore it. Yes, we've been trapped by the same crowd that don't like it, unless they've heard it before, leaving me stuck flogging my progressive dead horse south of the border to the so-so and so's in through and throughs and this and that and buttered bread. I'm proud of it, whose values flip whenever it fucking suits them. And we're supposed to let it slide because the press has normalised the idea that racism is something we should humour. Yeah, the last bastion of hope this one straight nation had left is to converse in a manner that will pacify, divide and unite the room. But no one's talking. Rational thought has been forced into submission by the media through which all of our information is now consumed. Yes, fake news. It's fake news, mate. Boldness is an idiocy, surbound by its own stupidity. It does not realize it has already sentenced itself completely to death. So boldness is an idiocy, surbound by its own stupidity. It does not realize it has already sentenced itself completely to death. Boldness is an idiocy, surbound by its own stupidity. It does not realize it has already sentenced itself completely to death.
Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. That was Dead Horse by Yard Act.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with National MP Ryan Hamilton.
Last week, New Zealand was included in a list of countries the US threatened with new tariffs of 12.5%, alleging that they imported goods produced through forced labour. While the government has rejected these accusations, Trade Minister Tom Nicolay has said that, due to the volatility of the Trump administration, these threats were not a surprise. At the same time, New Zealand has boosted its defence spending, while comments made by US Secretary of Defence Pete Hegseth labelled NZ and other countries as freeloading allies due to their low spending, bringing the relationship between the US and NZ under increasing scrutiny. Last week also saw local government minister Simon Watts reveal changes to local government committees that would strip unelected members of said committees of a deciding vote on changes, in a move to curb what the government says is undemocratic policy, which has been met with criticism. This week, I spoke with National MP Ryan Hamilton about these topics, starting with the US tariffs. Last week, news came that the US may implement a new 12% tariff on New Zealand. This comes as a part of a potential crackdown on the import of goods that the US alleges were made with forced labour. What is the national government's response to these claims, and did the tariffs come as a surprise?
No. Minister Todd McClay has said that he's surprised about the announcements. There's a little bit of volatility coming out of Washington in this regard. So we're, I guess we're expecting a bit of flex, but you know, we're one of 60 countries named, so it's not like we're, you know, we've just been isolated or anything like that. And you know, there was a suggestion that, you know, we're encouraging or somehow encouraging forced labour, which we completely reject. And as you're probably aware, we've actually in fact got a cross-party anti-slavery bill coming through the House as well. So yeah, we don't really accept that phrasing.
And how do these tariffs and these accusations reflect or affect the relationship between New Zealand under a national government and the US?
Well, we're obviously just focused on continuing to build the relationship and, I guess, navigate these bumps along the road. We sold about 4% more by value to the US than last year when there was no tariff. So, in fact, you know, our trade relationship's actually, well, the transactional value is actually getting stronger. So it shows that we're able to mitigate, you know, that, because obviously US consumers are still wanting what New Zealand produces and they're happy to pay a bit more for it, which is great to see.
And this comes soon after Defence Minister Chris Pink announced rises in defence expenditure to hit a target of 2% of our GDP in the next 8 years. That, in turn, came near the US Secretary of Defence, Pete Hegseth, also criticising New Zealand as freeloading as an US ally due to our low military spending. What does the National Party say to concerns that New Zealand is doing what the US wants despite the threat of these tariffs and the economic strain caused on New Zealanders by the US intervention in the Middle East?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously there's a bit of noise and you know, we don't find those comments particularly helpful. But, you know, we are a smaller country, and if you look at what we are doing with the resources we've got, I mean, surely the, you know, the trajectory of the spending increase based on our population and historical spending shows that, you know, we take this seriously and we're up to do our part in, you know, the international world, you know, of rules and order. So we're comfortable that we're doing the right thing and that we're an ally, we're a supporter and a partner.
Last week also saw local government minister Simon Watts announcing changes to make it so unelected committee members cannot vote on committee decisions. What is the government's logic behind this change?
Well, we've been, I guess, clear when we were campaigning previously in 23 around the co-governance model, and we spoke strongly about the need for you know, democratically elected people. And so we repealed the, you know, Three Waters co-governance model, and we said, look, we're happy with co-governance arrangements on natural endowments like rivers, mountains, etc., but for publicly funded assets, they should be led and held by democratically accounted people. And then obviously there was an example in the far north where there was a, you know, huge amount of unelected members involved or appointed and making decisions, and we feel that it's actually enough's enough and it needs to go back to basics.
This government has spoken a lot about leaving local governments to their own devices. How does this intervention match with this ethos and approach?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I think, yeah, obviously we want locally delivered, you know, outcomes, local delivering local, but we've sort of felt we need to first, you know, reset the ground rules, because, you know, some councils are saying, yeah, we're delivering local, but we're also tweaking the way that, you know, elected members or non-elected members can have their say. So saying, no, we do want local input, but everyone's got to play by the same, you know, democratic principles, i.e. elected people making those decisions. And even with local government reform, we are actually saying, hey, we're going to give you a head start, because this is something New Zealand has realised for a long time, that we've got, you know, too many council organisations across, you know, essentially 2 to 3 islands of 5 million people. But rather than just say, you know, like the last government did with Three Waters, and they said, hey, we think you need four water entities all over the country, we're actually saying, hey, here's an opportunity for you to shape up what you think makes sense to you, like we did with the waters model, and then come to us with a solution and we'll work with you. We're giving you a 3 months head start. If not, then we're going to shape it up. So we are trying to find that sweet spot of, you know, local decision making versus a need for, you know, centrally, you know, a more cohesive response across New Zealand.
Tauranga Mayor Mahi Drysdale has questioned these changes with the committees alongside water governance changes to create council-owned companies that cannot be manned by elected officials. When we look at the control here given to unelected officials and to local government committees through these changes, where does the national government see the difference here?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not sure if we're going to have any elected representation on those committees or not. I haven't seen that detail. But I guess, you know, in that instance, we're trying to create more transparency around the water entity, and we're looking for a high level of governance experience. What we're seeing across some councils is elected members, whilst that might be a truer sense of democracy, they may not have the competence and skills to run what are essentially going to be multi-billion dollar operations. And with their ability to borrow more funding or more debt with the local government, New Zealand, they can borrow up to, you know, 100% more than they currently could. You know, that's a lot of, it's a big mortgage, and so we are trying to ensure we get that balance right. And obviously, they'll still feed into the local government and vice versa, so there'll be plenty of opportunity for, I guess, transparency of process.
That was National MP Ryan Hamilton on potential US tariffs on New Zealand, the relationship between the US and NZ, and new changes to local government committees.
That was our weekly chat with National MP Ryan Hamilton.
Children eat worms and bugs and all sorts of things when they crawl in around.
The Wire.
The Carrington Hospital, former Carrington Hospital, also known as Building 1, was built in 1867 and stands as a monument to Victorian-era healthcare in New Zealand. Until 2018, this Category 1 heritage building was part of Unitec's Mount Albert campus, but was sold to the government as part of the Carrington Residential Development, or Te Kukunga Waka. The goal was to build 4,000 new homes in collaboration with Ockham Residential and various iwi. However, concerns have been raised by locals about the degrading state of Building 1, as well as whether local infrastructure will be able to cope with intensification. I spoke to a range of individuals who want to see the building preserved and attended some of their protests. I also reached out to the owners, Ockham and Marutuahu, for comment. I first spoke to Chris Casey, chair of the Cachet Foundation, formerly known as the Point Chef Social Enterprise Trust, an organisation which has spearheaded a movement to see the building restored and repurposed as a local community arts and education hub. About the current state of Building 1, why it is deteriorating, and how it could be fixed and repurposed. Could you tell us a bit about the history and significance of Building 1, the former Carrington Hospital, and why it's a Category 1 heritage site?
So it's established in the early 1860s as an asylum, sort of a Victorian model based on the concept of nature nurture. So the concept of the hospital back then was the environment helped with healing. I don't know about, you know, it wasn't modern psychiatry like it is today. And also, I suppose, people were sent there when probably they didn't need to be sent there. You know, mild depression, postnatal depression, all sorts of things. Patients started going in there, I think, about late 1860s. It was a working farm. It burnt down in the late 1880s, I think. The front of it was rebuilt. And then over a period of time, as there were more patients, it then grew and they built more wings onto it. So it was given a heritage category because of, one, it's old, and two, of its significance to the area. So probably at the time it was the biggest employer around Mount Albert Point Chef.
So we've heard stories about vandalism, thefts and break-ins. What is the current state of the building at the moment?
The building's a mess. It's a disgrace. So it was a hospital up until 1992, I think. Then the Ministry of Education took it over for Unitec, and the Unitec's architecture design department moved in there for nearly 30 years. So it was a functioning educational hub full of creativity and vibrancy, and now, you know, in the last 4 years, the reality of a building that is empty and not activated and not full of energy is prone to people misusing it. And the managers of the building, who were the government, didn't secure it well enough. And now we see lots of vandalism. People have got in, tagged it, jumped in, smashed windows, broken tiles, opened it up for the elements. So if you think what it looked like 4 years ago compared to now, it's a mess.
Yeah, and what do you anticipate the future of Building 1 will be? Are you worried it might deteriorate to a point of no return?
Yeah, well, the common thing in heritage preservation is that's called demolition by neglect. So it's a Heritage 1 building. It should be important to the government and also to Auckland Council in terms of its category. Cynically, you would think that it's been allowed to slowly rot from the outside in and the inside out. You know, your house, my house, if you don't fix the roof, water gets in, everything rots. I mean, it's up to the government and the managers of it, whoever's going to own it. You know, they've got a very vital building. I don't think it's really perfect for housing. We've always thought as a community that it would be an amazing community centre and community arts and lots of maybe education, lots of different things, maybe a little bit of housing. But yeah, if you don't fix the roof now and you get through winter, it's going to cost you millions and millions and millions of dollars more.
To what extent has there been consultation with the public on this matter?
Well, there's no consultation. I mean, we have a Facebook page called Building One, which we set up when we did a feasibility study for the government or of what we thought the community use could be of that building. There's a disclaimer in the report that, you know, iwi and government don't have to abide by our findings, but we did a massive survey of the community, open days, etc., of what it could be used for. The Crown, though, and we respect iwi's right of first refusal, under the treaty. So if they end up owning the land and the building, fair play to them. But we would hope that they would retain the building and keep it, you know, keep its heritage values, but also keep it weather tight. That would be the most important thing.
Has your movement to preserve the building gained much traction?
Yeah, I think we've got traction because media are asking questions, which is important. The Carrington development, which is a massive development, you know, from the front of Building 1 all the way to the back of the Unitech Polytech to Phyllis Reserve, three iwi groups. So it's a great opportunity to build some really cool housing and do some really neat developments. We always thought that as a group who's interested in the building and also the environment around it, that heritage could coexist really well with housing and also the sanctuary gardens and the trees and the local environment and the ecology. At the moment it's pretty debrided of trees, and we have always been pro-development. We fought for the back of the building and went to the High Court a few years ago, and when the back of Carrington Hospital was going to be demolished to put a road in, and we thought that was pretty silly. And we used lots of wonderful heritage architects and planners and engineers to show that a road could go around the building and you could still keep a development. So we've always tried to be proactive and solution-based. So in terms of protest, I suppose we as a community see a building that we love. The reality, Liam, is for 30 years, the architecture design department and amazing artists and sound musicians and some of the most amazing artists that are in Aotearoa at the moment have gone through that place. There used to be 2,000 staff and students in there, lots of vitality, creativity. And, you know, we've reached out beyond the community to, you know, the two of the esteemed kaumātua were of the site, and they were poets and painters and amazing entrepreneurs themselves, and said, you know, fill the place with creative opportunities and outrageous expression is what they said. So they see that the building could be used as a local kura, you know, a school of outrageous expression. It could be education, it could be the arts. And that's what our study and our survey to the community in 2020 showed. The owners, what they want to do with it is their decision. We just said, hey, this is what the community, who are your neighbours, and potentially even the people who might live in your apartments, have thought about the place. And it would be cool to keep respecting the building.
What do you think this says about New Zealand, and in particular Auckland's ability to look after its heritage?
Look, there are some really amazing people who work within heritage. There hasn't been enough funding for it to protect buildings, so it's pretty woeful, but that possibly goes to where government doesn't have enough teeth and it allows people to knock things down. But you've seen really hopeful activity lately with the funding for the St. James, for example, to go ahead. But it's an isolation, and if you're going to get rid of built heritage, then what do you have? Heritage also has a huge economic value when you maintain buildings, and even costs you a little bit of money, the value in the long term is huge and exponential. People come to have a look at that. So, you know, in a mind's eye, people came off boats or, you know, ships down, you know, as tourists, or got off the plane and they went to a really funky place that could be building one in the future, full of galleries and maker spaces and authenticity, then that would be hugely beneficial for the economics of Auckland, and also for young people and artists who are authentic. And let's be honest, you know, if it wasn't for people like, you know, BFM and creatives, who are 5% of the GDP and economy, now last year was $18 billion, it's not a nice to have, it's a real thing. You know, the government should put more money into supporting these things, because there is an economic return. We know the social return, but the economic return is massive. And, you know, it can be done, and it doesn't have to be as expensive as I think to rehabilitate the building. You could do it in kind of timely fashion. You know, community, government, council, funders, it can all be done if you've got a will. And we'd be more than happy to support iwi or Ockham or whoever it was. But if they don't want to do it, then give it to someone else. The reality is, here's a listed Category A building sitting there with big holes in the roof, which are the most important things at the moment. I know the bylaw says that council can only enforce the entrances. So you and I, Liam, could get out with our, you know, our drills and our hex screws and some plywood, and probably we'd have a little team and we could fix it in a weekend. But they need some serious work for the roof. And again, that could be done, but there has to be a will. So we'll do a little poster campaign in the next few weeks, and you'll see our signs up, and it'll say, "Fix the bloody roof."
To gauge how the public has been engaging with Building 1, I attended two protests held outside Carrington Building 1 on Saturday the 30th of May and the 6th of June. I met with individuals involved in the movement to see the building protected, fixed and repurposed. There I spoke to Mount Albert MP Helen White and local cafe owner Gareth Hughes. I first spoke to Mount Albert MP Helen White about her vision for Carrington Building 1 and the role that government has in its future. Yeah, so we're here next to Carrington Building 1. Yeah, what are your hopes for the future use of this building?
Well, I think it's got incredible potential. Like, we're building a lot of amazing houses, like the Ockham development here. This is really great to see affordable housing come in to our area, but we need to make sure that we have a lot more community space as well, because that's what makes it all work, and it makes it a really nice place to live. And I can see the potential in this building. I can see the potential we're going to need new schools. Mount Albert Grammar's at 3,500 kids. Like, that's crazy. Avondale's full. So where are the kids that we're putting into the Carrington site going to go to school? I can see a real opportunity here. And I can see an opportunity for an art space and for community space. I mean, this is a community where the library was demolished recently because it was unhealthy, and we really noticed it when we didn't have the library. Things went downhill fast at Point Chev. Imagine if this building became a source of community well-being. It would be amazing.
Yeah, and what do you think a building like this could do for the arts community?
My imagination goes wild when I see this building and I think about the things we could do with it. You know, apparently it was really beautiful inside. I was just talking to someone who used to work in it when it was in its old days, and it had black and white tiles in the foyer and a lot of wood, and it was a really interesting space. Imagine if we had an art gallery in there, and we had a coffee shop, and we had a library maybe in there. You know, I see these places as having so much potential also for our social services. Imagine if we had some of the community groups hanging out in that space together.
What is the role of government? What is it doing now, and what more can be done for this building?
Well, I think that there are things like the education department that could look at the site, and there's the arts and heritage that could look at the site. You know, these are conversations that I can have. I can lobby, basically, for these things. I mean, we all know that it's pretty tough out there at the moment, but I think we underestimate how much better people's lives are if you give them space they can hang out in free. It can make all the difference when things are tough.
Yeah, and what are you hearing from sort of the local community about this building?
You can hear the toots on the road. They're constant. People really want to save this building, and they've got a point. And the first I heard of the tiles on the roof being removed and the worry that water was getting into the building was actually up at a community meeting I held on green space and community space. And this was top of mind for the people in this area. They were really worried that they're going to lose this beautiful space because the tiles have been removed and the water's getting in. So I wrote to the mayor about that, and luckily we've had a little bit of action since then, so I'm proud that we're on the way to highlighting the issue. I think we're going to see so much more interest in the value of community space as we grow more houses, and I want to make sure that affordable houses doesn't just mean no community, it means affordable houses in a great community.
Here is what Gareth Hughes, operator of the local Waterview Coffee Project, had to say. What does the Carrington Building 1 mean to you?
Well, I grew up just passing it every day as a kid, so it's always been in my memory and my psyche, and I think it's a very important part of this community. I find it really incredibly sad to watch it decay and be ignored and neglected. So that's the sadness is caused by what I see, but I'm also really I'm angry at the fact that it could have been very different. It could have been something really interesting, really exciting for the community, for this part of Auckland and for Auckland generally. I think the potential was massive, and that seems to be rotting into the ground now.
Well, what do you hope it could be used for?
Well, I've always liked the idea of it becoming a first and foremost a community hub for incubation of business ideas, of craft ideas, of artistic ideas, a place that's supported by the community, it's for the community, and it just, that kind of bringing that kind of energy to the to this area and to this building, it could have been something really magical, I think.
Why are you here today? What are you protesting for?
I'm specifically protesting the fact that there's this very conscious effort to destroy the building, it looks like, from the outside anyway. And I've been asking questions. I mean, I don't spend a lot of time discussing stuff on social media, but when I see the discussion around Carrington Building 1 and then different people asking questions about who's responsible, I just see people saying they're responsible, we weren't responsible for this, we aren't responsible for this, the owners aren't responsible. And the question I've always had from the get-go is, how did it get to this point? Why was there not a clear plan of how it would be handled moving forward, rather than being given to what appears to be, from my understanding, to Iwi and Ockham to manage together, and no clear plan on how to protect it as a heritage site and then to develop it for the community. Despite those words being repeated, I don't see that in actual fact. It looks to me like there's a decision to make it uninhabitable so that something else has to be built instead.
After the protest had ended, I met a local high school student outside Building 1 who claimed to be a regular visitor of the building and has extensively explored the interior. We spoke about what Building 1 means to him and about what he has witnessed inside about the deteriorating state of the building. What does Building 1 mean to you? How long have you been coming here?
I've been coming here since about February 2025. I usually hang out here with two of my other friends, and we usually just hang out in the lecture room or the big blue carpeted room with the projector on the top. That's about it. It's mostly just a hangout spot, nothing more, nothing less. Slowly getting torn apart, though, so I don't know how long that's going to last. So,
what inspired you to start coming to this building?
I saw it, and I thought it looked really cool, and I may as well try it out once, and then I just kept coming back, so nothing's stopping me so far.
Did you have a favorite room?
Oh, I definitely have a favorite room, the big blue carpet room with the projector holder on the top. That is a beautiful room. I love that room.
How is the inside of the building changing over time?
More spray paint, more broken windows. I mean, some doors that I couldn't access before are being kicked open, so I guess that is a plus side to the vandalism. But overall, it's just the conditions getting worse and worse. So
Do you notice a lot of vandalism going on here?
Definitely. No doubt in my mind. Every time I come back, there's something new.
Do you know what has happened to the roof tiles that apparently are falling off?
My idea is the roof is either rotting away and dropping the tiles, or it's just some kids hopping around on the tiles and they're falling off from the body weight.
Yeah, but you haven't noticed anything yourself?
Nah, not much. I've seen a few people climbing on it before when I'm out on the scaffolding out on the outside of the building, but nah, even the people who climb on it, the tiles don't really fall off, so...
How many people would you say come here on a regular basis? And, like, what's the most people you've seen in this building at any time?
Most people I've seen in this building at any time is probably 15 for their friend's birthday party. And I don't know. The number has dropped significantly since barricades and security cameras went up. So I would say I meet around 2-3 people here a week.
Cool. What kind of people do you find here?
Homeless people are limited now since the security cameras and borders have gone up. More or less just kids climbing in through windows trying to see what's in there. Yeah, it used to be absolutely ridden with homeless people when the borders hadn't gone up and when all the windows were accessible.
How is the security in here? Like, do you often see security guards coming in?
Well, I often see a cop car parked outside, but that's because there are people like walking around the building. Me, myself, I've never gotten caught, so I wouldn't say the security is too bad. They don't really care about this building enough to stop the break-ins. They just want to limit it, is what the construction workers who were building the border said. So, yeah, I'd say security is decent if it's actually needed, but if it's not needed, then they're just completely laying off of it.
I mean, have you noticed the developers coming in here? Did they ever do anything in this building?
Oh, no, I've never seen anyone who owns this building come in here, ever. I think they're scared of this place. They've never stepped foot on the private property. It's only construction workers.
Well, would you like to see this building restored and fixed?
Yeah, I'd like to see it restored and fixed. Maybe give it... I mean, it would cost a lot of money, but I'd say if we actually tried, we'd be able to renew it and stuff, bring it back to its former days. But to be honest, the abandoned part of it is kind of what makes it special to a bunch of people. I wouldn't say that we shouldn't restore it. I would actually say that we should, because this place is just getting worse and worse, and eventually it's going to collapse in on itself and just be a pile of rubble.
If it were restored, how would you like to see this building used?
Probably as another part of Unitech. I was talking with my friends, saying if this building was ever renewed, we'd come here for college. And I was like, oh, that'd be a pretty cool idea, but I don't think that's happening anytime soon, so...
That was Chris Casey, Helen White, Gareth Hughes, a local high school student from Mount Albert, all speaking about the worsening state of the former Carrington Hospital Heritage Building and movements to see it fixed and repurposed. Representatives from Ockham and Marutuahu were not available for comment.
That's probably slightly off topic. What was the question again?
The Wire.
2 weeks ago, the 2026 budget revealed the government's spending and funding plan. Notably absent, however, is support for care workers, except for a minor boost to mileage rates while the fuel crisis is ongoing. The Air 2 union, however, has said that these changes do little to match the inflated costs and still leave support and care workers woefully unsupported in the midst of an already struggling health system. I spoke with the National Secretary of Air 2, Rachel McIntosh, about the state of care work in New Zealand and what this budget means for the priority given to care work by this government. Just to get us started, looking before this budget, what sort of state are the care and support systems in Aotearoa in?
The care and support system is in crisis and has been for some time, but it's just been intensifying over the past few years. And then there was insult added to injury, and actually more injury just over a year ago when the government changed the rules with no warning under urgency and essentially stripped away any chance of decent work for people working in the care and support industry by cancelling the pay equity legislation.
And looking at this budget in particular,
What sort of things have the government offered or changed that affect the care industry?
It's more what they have failed to do. There was a $400 million underspend in health that could have been ploughed back. It wouldn't have made a huge difference, but it certainly, this is worse, not having that $400 million spent in an industry that's in crisis, where workers are basically working in poverty. Home support workers, those are the ones who drive out to clients, which saves the government a huge amount of money, are basically paying for their own jobs, driving with inadequate compensation for the driving. So this budget has done nothing to address that. And when it, what it could have done with that $400 million has chosen not to. And it is instead funding weapons and prisons and roads.
And just on kind of looking at the holes where the government hasn't put any help and support, other than kind of the support for these specific care workers, what other sort of glaring holes are there in what the government just isn't helping with?
Well, they're underfunding pretty much everything. And the spending that is described as new spending is essentially not even keeping up with ongoing need, so underinvestment in all areas that make life worth living at the expense of, you know, tax cuts for landlords, tax breaks for tobacco companies, and now increased investment in war and in prisons.
How does kind of leaving out any real support for the care system in this budget reflect the government? I mean, obviously you touched on the scrapping of the pay equity, but how does it kind of reflect the way that this government has approached both the care systems and other related systems?
Well, the government's choices speak really loudly about what they consider important. And so to deprioritise, defund and underpay people doing this vital work has a huge effect. It has an effect on the whole system. It has an effect on the lives of the people still doing the work. It has an effect on the system being unable to attract people to come and work there. People are leaving the care and support industry because the pay and conditions are so bad, and this government has done nothing. In fact, they've done worse than nothing to change that. And obviously, there is a flow-on effect to the people receiving care. So elderly people, disabled people, people on ACC, people who are people with mental health, in mental health crisis, the most vulnerable people in our communities, have inadequate staff to look after them, have their basic needs met. And the value of that work is, it's impossible to measure, because what it does is, with great skill and care and sensitivity, enables hundreds, thousands of people in our country to live lives of dignity and to participate in their communities because of the basic care that they are getting and the understanding that they get from people performing care and support work. And if you underfund that, not only the workers suffer, but the people receiving the care suffer as well. And that reflects badly on our whole society.
And you've touched on it kind of throughout here, but the government, obviously a lot of attention is going to go towards the government's funding of the Defence Force. When we look at that funding compared to what, you know, these workers are receiving and how that will affect the most vulnerable New Zealanders, what does it say about the government's priorities that they're putting the money there and not here?
It says that they are prioritising something that does not give people a decent life over things that can, about care, support, a high quality, fully funded public health system, so that everyone in our country can live with dignity because they know that they will be cared for when needed.
And so what is it then, if we're talking about funding for these workers and support, what is it that Etu want to see from either this government or other governments going forward in terms of actual tangible help?
Yeah, so the most urgent pay equity sector is care and support. And so what we want is an immediate what they call an uplift, so immediate funding of the underpaid care and support work, which has been assessed and agreed at around about 30% below where it should be. This government cancelled that agreement between the employers and the workers and actually a government agency. This government came in and said, no, we're not doing that any longer. So the answer is there. 30% increase in pay is what is needed urgently.
I mean, that's all the specific questions that I have, but is there any other kind of areas of this that you particularly want to kind of bring to light?
Just that the decisions politicians make have real effects on people's lives, and it's absolutely essential that people in Aotearoa use their democratic right to vote and vote for a government that will care for people and make decisions and spend money on making our society better for everyone.
That was National Secretary of Etu, Rachel McIntosh, on what the budget means for care and support workers.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te o taka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a rātou e kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā.
That's a wrap on the Tuesday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Dr. Alan Blackman, National MP Ryan Hamilton, Chris Casey of the Cachet Foundation, Mount Albert MP Helen White, Gareth Hughes, and Etu's Rachel McIntosh. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up, we've got the 1 to 4 with Jin.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.